Imagine this scenario. You are standing at the bedside of a patient on a cardiac telemetry unit. You happen to glance up at the monitor. You are watching the rhythm, that familiar PQRST complex. But then you notice something odd. The T wave looks flattened out, almost like a deflated balloon, and right after it, there is this strange extra little boop bumpa U wave. At the exact same moment, your patient looks at you and says, "I don't know what's wrong, but my legs feel like jelly. I'm having these terrible cramps in my calves."
That is a classic textbook setup. And the question screening in your head right now shouldn't just be, who do I call? It should be, what is the one lab value I need to check immediately before this rhythm devolves into something lethal?
If you shouted potassium at your dashboard, you are on the right track. But here's the thing about the NCLEX. Simply memorizing potassium equals cramps isn't enough to pass. The exam wants to know if you understand why the heart is reacting that way, exactly how a drop in potassium wrecks the heart's electrical conduction system, and most importantly, how to fix it without accidentally stopping the patient's heart entirely.
Exactly. It's not a vocabulary test, it's a safety test. They want to know if you are safe to be left alone with a patient.
So welcome in. I'm your host, and this is ConceptCast from nursingnotes.org.
And I'm here to help you connect the dots between the textbooks and the bedside.
Today, our mission is to decode what I like to call the invisible engine of the body. We are talking fluids, electrolytes, acid-base balance, and the critical labs that act as the dashboard lights telling us if the engine is about to fail.
This is a huge topic for the NCLEX. We often call it the safety pyramid. If you look at the material we're working with today, it emphasizes that fluids and electrolytes aren't just dry chemistry. They are the foundation of physiological stability. If you mess up an electrolyte replacement, or if you miss a sign of fluid overload during a transfusion, the patient crashes. It happens fast.
We are going to cover everything from the king of electrolytes to the specific dangers of TPN and blood transfusions. We have a lot of ground to cover, but we're going to break it down so it sticks. Let's get into the fundamentals.
Let's do it.
We have to start with the big one, the absolute king of the jungle when it comes to electrolytes, potassium, K plus.
Potassium is the cellular gatekeeper for the heart. That is the mental image you need. It governs cardiac contractility and electrical conduction. The normal range you must burn into your brain is 3.5 to 5.0 milliAQQL.
3.5 to 5.0, that's the golden window. Now, it's interesting because the body is basically a bag of potassium floating in an ocean of sodium. Most of the potassium is inside the cell.
Right. And that concentration gradient, high potassium inside, low potassium outside, is what creates the electrical potential that allows your heart to beat and your muscles to contract. When that ratio gets thrown off, even by a little bit, the electrical system goes haywire.
So let's go back to that intro scenario, the U wave. This is hypokalemia, right? Low potassium.
Correct. Hypokalemia is anything less than 3.5. But let's look at the mechanism, because the NCLEX loves physiology. When extracellular potassium is low, the resting membrane potential of the muscle cells becomes hyperpolarized. Basically, the heart muscle cells have trouble repolarizing, resetting for the next beat. That delay in resetting is what creates those ECG changes.
And that delay manifests as a U wave.
Exactly. The T wave represents the ventricles resetting. If potassium is low, that reset is sluggish. The T wave flattens out or even inverts. And then, because the repolarization is so prolonged, you see that extra bump afterwards, the U wave. It's a sign that the electrical reset is lagging dangerously behind.
That makes sense. It's like a camera flash taking too long to recharge. And physically, the patient isn't just lying there comfortably watching their monitor.
No. Think about the phrase low and slow. Potassium powers muscle contraction. Without enough of it, everything gets weak. You'll see skeletal muscle weakness, specifically those leg cramps we mentioned. The bowel muscles slow down, so you might see constipation or even an ileus. The pulse becomes weak, thready, and irregular.
Low and slow. I like that. It applies to the muscles, the gut, and the heart. Now, where are they losing this potassium? How does a patient get into this mess?
Usually, they are losing it from the gut or the kidneys. The most common NCLEX scenario is the patient on non-potassium-sparing diuretics. We're talking about your loop diuretics like furosemide Lasix or thiazides. These drugs force the kidneys to dump water, but they dump potassium right along with it.
This is a classic trap, right? The patient has heart failure, so we give Lasix to pull fluid off the lungs. But if we don't watch the labs.
Exactly. You fix the fluid overload, but cause a fatal arrhythmia because you depleted their potassium. So you'll often see these patients on a potassium supplement, to counteract that.
What about stomach losses?
Huge factor. Vomiting or nasogastric suction. Stomach acid is rich in electrolytes. If you have a patient with an NG tube set to suction, you are literally vacuuming electrolytes out of their body. You have to monitor their levels constantly. Also, Cushing's syndrome, where you have high cortisol, can cause the kidneys to excrete too much potassium.
Okay, so we have identified it. Potassium is 2.8. We see U waves. The doctor orders AV potassium. This is the danger zone. I was reading the safety protocols in our material, and they are written in bold red letters. What is the absolute number one safety rule here?
Never, ever, under any circumstances, do you push potassium the fourth bolus.
It seems like such a simple rule, but the consequences are devastating.
If you push potassium as a bolus, meaning you inject it rapidly directly into the vein, you will stop the heart instantly. It is lethal. High concentrations of potassium essentially freeze the heart muscle so it can't contract. It is actually the mechanism used in lethal injections.
That is a terrifying but effective way to remember it. So how do we give it safely?
It must be diluted and it must be infused slowly. We're talking typically no faster than 10 to 20 mV/Q per hour. And it should always be on an infusion pump to control the rate perfectly. You never rely on gravity for a potassium drip.
And one practical tip the notes mention, it burns, doesn't it?
It does. Potassium is very irritating to the veins. Patients will complain that their arm feels like it's on fire. You might need to slow the rate slightly or ask the pharmacy to dilute it further, but you have to explain to the patient that we can't just speed it up to get it over with. Speed kills in this case.
Okay, let's flip the coin. Hyperkalemia. Mm-hmm. Too much potassium.
Oh, yeah.
Greater than 5.0.
This is equally dangerous, perhaps even more immediately life-threatening. The ECG looks totally different here. Instead of flattening out like in hypokalemia, everything tightens up and spikes. You get tall, peaked T waves.
Like a tent.
Exactly like a tent. The T wave shoots up to a sharp point. The QRS complex widens. The PR interval prolongs. If you see tall, peaked T waves in an exam question stem, you don't even need to finish reading the sentence. Your first thought must be hyperkalemia.
And if you ignore it.
That widened QRS will stretch further and further until it looks like a sine wave, and then the patient goes into ventricular fibrillation or a systole. The heart just stops.
Who is at risk for this? Who is the classic hyperkalemic patient?
The kidneys are responsible for excreting 80 to 90% of our potassium. So if the kidneys fail, potassium builds up rapidly. Renal failure is the number one cause. If a patient misses a dialysis appointment, they are a walking hyperkalemia time bomb.
But there's another cause that catches students off guard. We talked about the bag of potassium analogy earlier.
Right. Tissue damage. Potassium lives inside the cell. It's the major intracellular cation. If you have a massive burn, a crush injury from a car accident, or a tumor lysis syndrome, those cells burst open. All that potassium that was safely inside the bag spills out into the bloodstream all at once.
So the trauma patient isn't just at risk for bleeding, they are at risk for cardiac arrest from potassium release.
Precisely. You have to watch the ECG on burn patients for this exact reason. Also, Addison's disease adrenal insufficiency can cause potassium retention because they lack aldosterone.
Okay, so potassium is the heart monitor. Low K equals U waves and low and slow. High K equals peak T waves and cardiac standstill. Let's move to the next heavyweight, sodium.
If potassium is the heart monitor, sodium is the brain monitor.
Why the brain specifically?
Because sodium regulates osmolality. That's a fancy word for the water balance between the blood and the cells.
Yeah.
The rule you need to know is water follows sodium. Or, more accurately, water moves to where the salt is higher to when diluted. If sodium shifts rapidly, water shifts rapidly. And the brain is enclosed in a hard skull. It doesn't have room for swelling or shrinking.
That puts it in perspective. Normal range.
135 to 145 mmHg.
Let's talk hyponatremia first. Low sodium, under 135. What is happening physically?
Think about the physics. If the blood has low sodium, it is dilute. The inside the cells has relatively more sodium, so water rushes out of the blood and into the cells to balance things out. The cells swell up like a water balloon.
And when brain cells swell?
You get cerebral edema. The symptoms reflect that increased intracranial pressure. Confusion is usually the first sign. Then headache, lethargy, and if it drops severe and fast, seizures and coma.
So if I have a patient who is suddenly confused and seizing and they've been retaining fluid, I should be checking the sodium.
Absolutely. Causes are often diuretics again or fluid overload, what we call dilutional hyponatremia. If a patient with heart failure drinks 3 gallons of water, they dilute their sodium pool. This is also the danger of SIADH, syndrome of inappropriate antidiuretic hormone, where the body hoards water.
Now, hypernatremia, High sodium, over 145.
Now the situation reverses. The blood is salty and concentrated. Nature wants to dilute that salt, so water gets pulled out of the cells and into the blood. The cells shrivel up and dehydrate.
It sounds like a dehydration issue.
It almost always is. The cells are screaming for water.
What are the signs? The notes list a mnemonic? Fried salt?
Yes. F for flushed skin, R for restless, you know, irritability, I for increased fluid retention and blood pressure, E for edema, D for decreased urine output. But the hallmark, the thing the patient will actually complain about, is extreme thirst.
And the physical exam?
Look at the mouth. The mucous membranes get dry and sticky. The tongue can look red, swollen, and fuzzy. It's not just dry mouth. It looks parched. Dehydration is the big one. Or diabetes insipidus, which is the opposite of SIADH. In diabetes insipidus, they are peeing out all their free water, gallons of it, leaving the sodium behind to concentrate in the blood.
I want to touch on diet here, because the NCLEX loves to ask about food trays. We think we know what salt is, but there are traps.
Huge traps. Students think salt means the salt shaker. But in the hospital and on the exam, the enemy is processed food.
What are the big offenders?
Canned soups are number one. A single serving can have your entire daily allowance. Ketchup, soy sauce, salad dressings, lunch meats, and cheese.
Cheese, really?
Yes, cheese is very high in sodium. The NCLEX will give you a menu choice. Option A, grilled cheese and tomato soup. Option B, baked chicken with fresh peas and cauliflower. Option A sounds like comfort food, but for a cardiac patient, it's a sodium bomb. You pick the fresh veggies every time.
Fresh is best. That's the takeaway. Let's move to the twitchy twins, calcium and magnesium.
I like calling them the twitchy twins because they both have a profound effect on neuromuscular excitability. They act like sedatives for the nerves. When they are high, things are quiet. When they are low, things get twitchy.
Let's start with calcium. Normal range is roughly 9.0 to 10.5 mgDL. What happens when it drops? Hypocalcemia.
Think tetany. Calcium stabilizes the nerve membrane. When calcium is low, the threshold for firing a nerve signal drops. The nerves become hyperexcitable. They fire when they shouldn't.
There are two famous signs for this. I feel like every nursing student memorizes the names, but the notes here really emphasize how to do them correctly. Let's role play them. First, Shravastik sign.
So C for Shravastik, C for cheek. This is a test for facial nerve irritability. You tap the patient's face just in front of the ear, about 2 centimeters anterior to the earlobe, right over the facial nerve.
And what are you looking for?
A twitch. If the lip pulls up or the facial muscles spasm on that side, that's a positive Shravastik. It means their calcium is critically low and their nerves are on a hair trigger.
And Trousseau sign. This one seems more reliable clinically.
It is more specific, but you have to do it right. You put a blood pressure cuff on the arm and inflate it above the patient's systolic pressure. You are essentially cutting off arterial blood flow to the arm.
For how long?
That's the key. You have to leave it there for about 3 minutes. The ischemia, that lack of blood flow, makes the nerves even more irritable. If the calcium is low, the hand will start to spasm. The wrist flexes, the fingers extend and press together. It looks a bit like a swan neck. That carpal spasm is a positive Trousseau's sign.
I always remember Trousseau keeps his hand in a weird position. Now, what causes the calcium to crash like this? There is one specific surgical scenario the NCLEX is obsessed with.
The post-thyroidectomy patient.
The thyroid surgery. Why?
Because of anatomy. The parathyroid glands are these four tiny little glands that typically sit right on the back of the thyroid. Their entire job is to regulate calcium. During thyroid surgery, they can be accidentally nipped, removed, or just stunned by the inflammation.
So the parathyroid hormone drops?
And calcium plummets. So if you have a patient fresh out of thyroid surgery and they say, my lips feel tingling or my fingers feel numb, that is circumoral paresthesia. That is the first sign of tetany. You need to run to check the calcium and have calcium gluconate ready.
That is a priority assessment. Don't just dismiss it as nerves from surgery. Okay, what about magnesium?
Magnesium is the forgotten electrolyte, but it's crucial. Normal is 1.3 to 2.1 MEQL. I want you to think of magnesium as the body's natural muscle relaxer. It calms everything down.
So if you don't have enough, hypomagnesemia.
The relaxer is gone. The body goes into overdrive. It mimics hypocalcemia perfectly. You get tremors, tetany, seizures, and hyperactive deep tendon reflexes. If you tap the knee, the leg shoots out wildly.
It looks a lot like hypocalcemia.
Very similar. They often happen together. But let's look at hypermagnesemia, too much magnesium. This is where this sedative analogy really helps. Now, the body's too sedated.
Too calm.
Exactly. The deep tendon reflexes don't just relax, they disappear. The respiratory drive goes down because the diaphragm muscle is too relaxed to contract. This is a major concern in labor and delivery.
Right, for preeclampsia. We give magnesium sulfate drips to prevent seizures.
Exactly. We give MAG to prevent the twitching of a seizure. But we have to watch the patient like a hawk. If their knee-jerk reflex disappears, that is the first sign of toxicity. It means their respiratory drive is about to shut down next.
Loss of reflexes equals magnesium toxicity. That is a solid checkpoint.
And just like potassium, it connects back to the renal system. Kidneys excrete magnesium. If kidneys fail, magnesium rises, and you get that dangerous sedation.
Let's shift gears to how the lungs and kidneys work together to keep our pH stable. Acid-base balance.
This is where students get intimidated. They see the numbers and panic. But we can simplify it. pH 7.35 to 7.45. CO2, 35 to 45. Bicarb, or HCO3, is 22 to 26.
We won't do a full ABG interpretation drill. We have other deep dives for that. But let's talk about the clinical signs and the physiology. Respiratory alkalosis. What does that patient look like?
Let's break the words down. Respiratory means it's a lung problem. Alkalosis means the pH is high, it's basic. How do lungs make the blood basic? By getting rid of acid. And CO2 is an acid.
So they are blowing off CO2.
Exactly. This is the hyperventilation patient, the classic panic attack. They are breathing incredibly fast. They're blowing off all their CO2 acid, so the pH rises.
And the symptoms?
Lightheadedness, tingling in the fingers. And here's a fun fact. The tingling happens because alkalosis makes calcium bind protein, so their free calcium drops. It's actually transient hypocalcemia.
Wow, see, that connects the dots. So a panic attack causes alkalosis, which causes pseudohypocalcemia. That is why they get numb fingers.
Exactly. Everything is connected.
And the opposite, respiratory acidosis.
That's the patient who isn't breathing enough. Hypoventilation. They're retaining CO2. Maybe it's a COPD patient with air trapping, or an opioid overdose where the respiratory drive is depressed. They are holding on to acid, so the pH drops.
Now, let's look at metabolic acidosis. This is usually a kidney or metabolic problem, but the lungs try to fix it. There is a specific breathing pattern associated with metabolic acidosis that shows up on exams constantly.
Kussmaul's respirations.
Describe that for us.
It's distinct. It is deep and rapid. It's not just fast, shallow panting like a panic attack. It's deep, driving, labor-intensive breaths. This is most famous in diabetic ketoacidosis, or DKA.
Why does the body do that?
The body is full of metabolic acid, in this case ketones. The brain senses this acidity and screams, get rid of acid. Dunce. The lungs can't pee out the ketones, but they can blow off CO2. So the patient hyperventilates with these deep breaths to dump CO2, trying to compensate for the metabolic acid.
So if you see a diabetic patient breathing deep and fast, they aren't just out of breath, they are compensating. Their body is trying to save itself.
Precisely. It's a compensatory mechanism.
Before we leave ABGs, there is a safety test mentioned in the source material called the Allen's test. This is done before you even draw the arterial blood.
Yes, this is critical for safety. We usually draw ABGs from the radial artery in the wrist. It's convenient, but arterial sticks are traumatic. What if that artery gets damaged or claps off during the stick? You need to know that the hand will still get blood.
From the ulnar artery, the backup supply.
Right. So the Allen's test verifies that the ulnar artery is patent and working. Here's the procedure. You ask the patient to make a fist. You use your thumbs to press down hard on both the radial and ulnar arteries at the wrist.
You are blocking all blood flow to the hand.
Yes. The patient opens their hand and it will be white and blanched because there is no blood. Now, the moment of truth. You release only the ulnar artery while keeping the radial blocked.
And what should happen?
If the ulnar artery is good, the hand should turn pink again within about 6 to 7 seconds. That is a positive Allen's test. It means it's safe to stick the radial because even if you destroy the radial artery, the ulnar can feed the hand.
And if it stays white?
Do not stick that wrist. You risk cutting off blood supply to the hand entirely, causing ischemia and necrosis. You have to try the other arm or the brachial artery.
That is a brilliant piece of physical assessment that protects you from a lawsuit and the patient from losing a hand. Okay, moving on to segment 5, vital signs and lab safety.
Let's talk hypertension staging. The guidelines have specific numbers you need to memorize because they determine treatment.
Prehypertension.
120 to 139 systolic or 80 to 89 diastolic. This is the warning zone. Lifestyle changes happen here.
Stage 1, hypertension.
140 to 159 systolic or 90 to 99 diastolic.
In stage 2.
Anything over 160 systolic or over 100 diastolic. This is where we get worried about stroke risk and organ damage.
What about temperature? There is a weird little trap about oral temperatures and nasal congestion.
It seems minor, but accuracy is everything. If a patient has a stuffy nose, they are forced to breathe through their mouth. That constant airflow over the tongue cools the oral cavity.
So the thermometer reads low.
Right. You might get a 97.5 when they're actually 99. If a patient is congested or has just smoked or just drank ice water, do not trust an oral temp. Go for tympanic, the ear, or axillary.
Let's hit the renal labs. BUN and creatinine, they are the dynamic duo of kidney function, but they tell us different things.
I love this distinction. Creatinine is the gold standard. Normal is 0.6 to about 1.2 or 1.3 mg/dL. Yeah. Creatinine is a waste product of muscle breakdown, and it is excreted exclusively by the kidneys. If creatinine is high, the kidneys are not filtering, period. It's just specific.
And BUN, blood urea nitrogen.
Normal is roughly 10 to 20 mg/dL. BUN is a bit trickier because it's affected by hydration status. It's what we call the dehydration detector.
So if I'm dehydrated, my BUN goes up.
Yes. If your BUN is high, say 35, but your creatinine is normal at 0.9, you are likely just dehydrated. The kidneys are working fine, that's the normal creatinine, but the blood is concentrated, which is the high BUN. We call this a high BUN to creatinine ratio.
But if both are high,
then you are looking at actual kidney damage or failure. The filter is broken.
Let's sprint through hematology. Platelets.
Normal is 150,000 to 400,000. The danger zone is usually under 100,000. That's thrombocytopenia. You put them on bleeding precautions.
Right.
Soft toothbrush, electric razor, no IM injections.
And if it drops really low?
If it drops extremely low, like 35,000 or below, you're at risk for spontaneous hemorrhage. This means they could bleed into their brain or gut without any trauma at all. That is a critical value.
And WBCs?
5,000 to 10,000. If it's high, infection.
Yeah.
If it's low, specifically under 5,000, or if the absolute neutrophil count is very low, you initiate neutropenic precautions. This is often for cancer patients on chemo.
What does that look like on the floor? It's basically reverse isolation, right?
Yes. We are protecting the patient from us and the environment. Strict hand washing is non-negotiable. No sick visitors. And importantly, no sources of standing bacteria.
This includes the gift shop stuff.
Right. No fresh flowers, no potted plants. The water in the vase and the soil are breeding grounds for bacteria like Pseudomonas. Also, no fresh fruits or raw vegetables. They can't eat a salad because of the bacteria on the lettuce. Everything must be cooked.
No flowers, no salad. Got it. Segment 6, nutrition and IV therapy. Let's talk TPN, total parenteral nutrition. This is IV food for people who can't use their gut.
TPN is serious business. It is a hypertonic solution packed with glucose, amino acids, and lipids. Because it's so sugary, it is a perfect culture medium for bacteria. Infection control is huge. You must change the tubing every 24 hours to prevent sepsis.
And you mentioned the sugar. The body reacts to that high sugar load, right?
Yes. The pancreas ramps up insulin production to handle that constant influx of high sugar TPN. Now, here is the scenario. The TPN bag runs dry. You call pharmacy, but they're backed up. It's going to be an hour before the new bag comes. Can you just cap the line and wait?
Instinct says yes, but physiology says no.
Correct. If you stop the TPN abruptly, the glucose source is gone instantly.
Mm.
But the insulin is still circulating at high levels. It takes time to drop.
So you have high insulin and no sugar.
Which equals a massive crash, severe rebound hypoglycemia. The patient can seize and die.
So what do you do? The bag is empty, pharmacy is slow, you need a bridge.
You hang dextrose 10% in water or D10W. It has a high enough sugar concentration to match the TPN and keep their blood sugar stable until the TPN arrives. You hang at the same rate as the TPN.
That is a save-the-day answer. D10W is your emergency backup. Now, looking at the IV site itself, complications. Infiltration versus phlebitis? How do I tell them apart?
It's all about temperature and color. Phlebitis is inflammation of the vein usually caused by irritation, like potassium. Think itis equals inflammation equals fire. It is red, warm to the touch, and often creates a palpable red streak, like a hard cord running up the arm.
And infiltration.
Infiltration is when the catheter slips out of the vein and fluid leaks into the surrounding tissue. The fluid is usually room temperature, which is cooler than body temp, so the site will be cool to the touch. The skin will be pale and edematous or swollen because it's full of fluid.
So cool and pale is infiltration. Warm and red is phlebitis.
Exactly. And for both, you stop the IV and remove it.
Yeah.
But for infiltration, you also elevate the extremity to help the fluid absorb.
Segment 7, blood administration. This is one of the most litigious and dangerous things nurses do.
The rules are strict for a reason. Informed consent first. 2 RN verification of the blood product, blood type, and patient ID at the bedside. No skipping this.
What fluid do you run with blood?
Only 0.9% normal saline. Nothing else. No dextrose. It causes the red blood cells to last and burst.
Yeah.
No lactated ringers. The calcium in it causes clotting in the line. Just saline.
And you have to stay with them.
For the first 15 minutes. This is the test dose period. If they're going to have a major hemolytic reaction from the wrong blood type or a severe allergic reaction, it usually happens in the first 50 milliliter or 15 minutes. You cannot delegate this to a tech. The RN must be there.
Let's break down the reactions. Scenario. You start the blood. 10 minutes in, the patient sits up and starts coughing. I can't breathe. You hear crackles in the lungs.
That is circulatory overload. Blood is thick. It adds volume. If you run it too fast, especially in an old person or a heart failure patient, you flood their lungs.
What is the fix?
Slow the infusion to a crawl or stop it. But physically, how do you position them? You want to decrease the return of blood to the heart. So you sit the patient upright with their feet dangling down.
Why feet down?
Gravity. We want to pull the blood in the legs and keep it away from the central circulation to give the heart and lungs a break.
Okay, different scenario. Rapid onset of chills, high fever, vomiting, shock.
That sounds like septicemia. The blood bag was contaminated with bacteria. That's a medical emergency.
And the third one, the patient complains of low back pain or flank pain.
That is the scary one. That is a hemolytic reaction.
Mm-hmm.
The body's antibodies are attacking the donor blood cells and destroying them.
Why the back pain?
Because when those red blood cells burst, they release free hemoglobin. That hemoglobin gets filtered by the kidneys, but the molecules are too big. They clog the kidney tubules like sludge. That causes acute kidney injury and intense flank pain.
So if they complain of back pain, stop the transfusion immediately.
Stop the blood. Do not flush the line. If you flush, you push the rest of the bad blood into them. You disconnect the tubing entirely, hang new tubing with normal saline to keep the vein open, and call the provider.
Finally, segment 8, pain management.
A fifth vital sign. The golden rule is, pain is whatever the client says it is.
Even if they are laughing on their phone, even if they are sleeping.
Yes. Distraction is a valid coping mechanism. Sleep can be an escape from pain. Never assume a patient is faking. You assess, you treat, and you reassess.
What about older adults? The material mentions they express pain differently.
They often underreport pain because they think it's a natural part of aging, which it is not, or they don't want to be a bother. Instead of verbal complaints, look for functional changes. Are they suddenly not sleeping? Are they confused? Are they refusing to socialize? Confusion in the elderly is often a sign of untreated pain or infection.
And a quick medication safety note that appeared in our material, ibuprofen and warfarin.
Dangerous combo. Ibuprofen is an NSAI. It causes GI irritation and affects platelet aggregation. Warfarin is an anticoagulant. Put them together, and the risk of a GI bleed skyrockets. You have to teach patients to avoid NSAIs if they are on blood thinners.
Okay, we have covered a massive amount of ground. We've climbed the safety pyramid. Now let's test your recall. It's time for rapid-fire checkpoints.
I'll ask the question. You, the listener, take a second to answer. Then I'll give the rationale. Question 1. You're reviewing an ECG strip and see a prominent U wave following a flattened T wave. The patient complains of leg cramps. What electrolyte imbalance is the priority? Take a second. Answer. Hypokalemia. Low potassium delays repolarization, causing the U wave and muscle cramping.
Question 2. A patient on TPN has an empty bag, and the new bag hasn't arrived from pharmacy. To prevent a complication, what IV solution should you hang immediately? Think about it. Answer, dextrose 10% in water, D10W. You need the high sugar content to prevent rebound hypoglycemia caused by high circulating insulin levels.
Question 3. You are assessing a patient post-thyroidectomy. You tap the cheek just in front of the ear, and the facial muscles twitch. What is this sign called, and what does it indicate? Give it a shot. Answer. Svostik sign. It indicates hypocalcemia. The parathyroids may have been damaged during surgery.
Question 4. You are assessing an IV site. The skin is cool, pale, and swollen. The patient complains of tightness. Is this phlebitis or infiltration? What do you think? Answer. Infiltration. Remember, phlebitis is fire red and hot. Infiltration is fluid leaking into tissue cool and pale.
Last one. Question 5. A patient receiving a blood transfusion begins to cough and has crackles in the lung bases. What is your priority positioning for this patient? Take a moment. Answer. Upright with feet dependent or dangling. This is circulatory overload. Sitting them up improves chest expansion and legs down pulls blood away from the heart to reduce the load.
How did you do? If you nailed those, you're thinking like a safe nurse.
Let's bring it home with a recap. The top 5 takeaways for the NCLEX from today's deep dive.
Number 1, potassium is cardiac.
Remember, low and slow for hypokalemia, that's your U waves. And remember, peaked and tight for hyperkalemia, those T waves. Both are lethal. And never, ever push potassium to the fourth.
Number 2, Calcium is neuromuscular.
Watch for the twitchy signs, Fostex, which is the cheek, and Trousseau's, which is the arm spasm. That means low calcium or sometimes low mag. High mag means everything stops, no reflexes.
Number 3, know your kidney labs.
Creatinine is the king. It is the specific indicator of kidney damage. BUN can just mean you need a glass of water.
Number 4, the lungs compensate.
If the metabolism is acidic, like in DKA, the lungs blow off CO2. That's your Kussmaul respirations. If the patient is hyperventilating from a panic attack, they blow off acid and get tingling fingers.
Number 5, safety first.
Validate the Allen's test before ABGs to save the hand. Neutropenic precautions means no fresh flowers or fruit to stop bacteria. And never stop TPN abruptly, or you crash the sugar.
Look, we know this is a lot. Fluids and electrolytes is basically where chemistry meets biology, and it can feel overwhelming when you're staring at a textbook.
It's normal to feel that way.
Yeah.
But remember, you don't need to be a chemist. You need to be a safe nurse. You are looking for patterns. The NCLEX isn't asking you to calculate moles of solute. It's testing your ability to spot the pattern, like a U-wave, and act to keep the patient safe.
Repetition is key. The more you hear low K equals U waves, the more automatic it becomes. You won't even have to think about it on test day.
And once you understand the why, like why this cell shrinking causes thirst in hypernatremia, you don't have to memorize it by rote. It just makes sense mechanically.
If you want these concepts to stick without the headache, check out nursingnotes.org. We're the only ones using music-powered learning to help you memorize this stuff faster, literally getting it stuck in your head like a catchy song. Plus, we have AI tools that quiz you just like we did today.
It's built by nurses who have been through the NCLEX for nurses who are about to crush it.
Keep studying, stay confident, and go dominate that exam.